You're listening to Peaches Aren't the Only Fruit podcast, a podcast in which we discuss Amazon Prime's TV series, A League of Their Own. I'm Karen.
And I'm Emma. So Karen, why don't you tell everybody, why are we doing this podcast?
We're doing this podcast because this is such an amazing TV series. It's got history. It's got sports. It's got queer women. It has got everything. And it's one of those things that is best enjoyed when talking to other people about it. It's so fun to discuss. But we know that a lot of people might not have people in their lives to talk to about it. I mean, you can only tell your cat so much about this TV show. So we wanted to create a podcast in which we discuss various aspects of it, and then listeners can go on social media and continue that conversation. We want to create community. We want to spread the word about A League of Their Own. And frankly, I just want to talk about it.
So why don't we jump into discussing episode one?
Okay, here's what we're going to do. Every episode, we're going to do a 2-minute recap of the episode just so that viewers remember what's in that specific episode. We're going to try and make it fun. We're going to try and make it exciting. And you're going to feel like you're there. And I'm going to run through it as absolutely fast as I can. So episode one, Batter Up, we meet Carson Shaw. She lives in Idaho. She is not a farmer. She is running for the train. It's a fantastic opening. It's hilarious. We understand that there's going to be comedy, drama. It's going to be wonderful. Gets on the train, going to Chicago. Small town girl meets Greta and Joe. They're all going to play baseball. We have our two love interests meeting, but we don't know it yet. They go to the field. This is exactly everyone's dream. They step out. Eyes get wide. This is amazing. Training montage. Everyone's practicing. Everyone's trying out, preparing, trying to make the team. Max and Clance show up. Max knows that they're not going to take her, but she still wants to try because it's the 1940s and racism is still a thing, just as it is today, just more hidden now. So, trying to make the team, they immediately kick her out, sad, unhappy. Okay, so moving on, we have kind of this scene after tryouts where Carson is kind of dealing with her feelings for her husband, Charlie, who's in the war. Greta comes in. It's a lesbian thing. She's got to brush her hair because that's what lesbians do on all the TV shows. Hair scene, right? Back to Max and Clance going home. Okay, we learn that Clance likes to draw. Clance is a fantastic drawer. We also learn that Max's family is not necessarily supportive of her dreams. Back to Carson and Greta, they're writing this letter to Charlie, they're drunk, they're, you know, being all cute and stuff. Back to Max again, dealing with her mom, the fact that her mom has found out she's gone to this tryout that she wasn't supposed to go to. Love this scene. The patrons of her mom's hairdresser salon are hilarious. We find out who's made the baseball team. It's the Peaches. We're about to meet all of these people. We're about to love them. We're about to love Maybelle and Shirley and Esty and Lupe and Jess because they're all Peaches now. Okay, to celebrate, they're going to the bar. And then Carson, Greta, talking, flirting. Carson doesn't even know she's flirting. Gets drawn into the back room. They kiss. Max is there. End of episode. We love it.
So that's some of the highlights of the show. We should get into, you know, what were your thoughts about it, Karen?
Oh my God. Emma, thoughts. So many thoughts. I mean, wow. So much to say. So I'm going to turn this back on you. Emma, so much going on, so much good stuff. What was your favorite part about the episode?
No, my favorite part was actually the friendship between Max and Clance. This is something that throughout the series, I feel like was so well documented of friendships between women. And, you know, series creator Abby Jacobson, something that I know her from is Broad City, a show that ran for several years on Comedy Central, which is about the friendship of two women in New York City. And Abby plays a character who's kind of similar to Carson, a little bit reserved, a little bit sort of nervous, and has a friend who's more bold, who's more out there. And I saw echoes of that in a great way in Max and Clance. And so one of my favorite scenes was when Max and Clance were riding the train back home after the failed tryouts. And you know, the mood was obviously sour. It was unhappy. It's unfair that Max didn't get to try out or be considered for the team. That whole vignette of them walking away from tryouts and then sitting on the train together, you just can see their bond, their friendship, how special it is when you have that person who, even when they know that your dreams seem outlandish, they seem crazy, they're going to be there for you 100%. And they're going to tell you, yeah, I know this is a little crazy, but I love you. I support you. I've got your back no matter what. And I should mention, Max does the same with Clance, who is a very talented comic book illustrator who has dreams of pursuing illustration. And again, we see throughout the series, but the kernel is really laid there that Max is supporting her friend, even when other people might say, oh, that's silly, that can't happen. So yeah, their interactions at the very beginning, leaving the tryouts unsuccessfully, riding the train home, I thought that was some of the best storytelling that sets the tone for the whole series. So yeah, what was your favorite moment?
Well, you know, I want to expand on that because something that I absolutely love is when Max and Clance arrive at the baseball field. I mean, we've had this montage of all the white players diving, catching, throwing. It's the perfect sports montage, right? As viewers, we're all primed for that. And Max shows up and Shante Adams, who plays Max, it's this beautiful moment where Max is like breathing it in. This is her dream. These are her people. And Clance, played by Bami Sola Ikumelo, is next to her just literally like, I'm about to shit my pants. And that's what she says. How about if I shit my pants? Do you think you'll make the team then? This moment to me is, you can't fabricate chemistry between two actors like that. It's there or it's not. And a lot of times when people do chemistry reads, it's for love interest. And this is an example. These two actresses did not do a chemistry read. This was just amazingly natural. This moment of hope on Max's side, fear on Clance's side. You said Clance wants to support Max and it's there and it's wonderful. And yes, it doesn't work out and they leave disappointed. And I love how Max is saying, it's fine. And Clance is like, it's not fine, but we're going to pretend it's fine. We have this sense of shared history that is so deep and so credible to the viewers. And I just think that this pairing, this friendship pairing, is absolutely one of the strongest things on the show. And it's just so wonderful to watch. But in terms of my favorite stuff, I mean, there's just so much and it's so hard to take it apart and narrow it down because I could literally talk about this for hours. But one thing that I do want to talk about is how they filmed the shot. So Greta pulls Carson into the back room of the restaurant, you know, with the, I want to tell you something or show you something. And of course, Carson is like, I have no idea what's about to happen. But the camera.
I mean, let me just stop you there. You know, sometimes you need to talk in private and you only need to go into the back storeroom of a bar. It was very noisy. There was a lot of music. Who knows what could have happened?
I know. It's so funny when you think about like what else she could have told her. But okay. So what I love about this is when we talk about these ideas of like consent or consensuality in a situation, this is something where Greta thinks that Carson is probably queer, doesn't know for sure. So she brings Carson into this room. And you see that Greta actually turns her own back to the wall. She's creating space for Carson to get out of the situation. And she kisses Carson. And I love the way the camera pans between these two characters. We see Carson's confusion. She didn't expect this. We don't know how much she knows about the existence of homosexuality in society. The show kind of assumes that everyone knows, like no one's like, oh my God, what's this? So this confusion on the part of Carson's face, her decision, what she wants to do, Greta, in essence, pushes her back, right? She gives Carson that opportunity. She creates the space for Carson to either step back further and leave or step forward. And of course, we see that Carson does go forward. She engages. And this is the consensual part. Carson makes that decision to continue the kiss. Then the break apart, triumph on Greta's face. And then she leaves, and then Carson's confusion. So the way we go back and forth between the characters is fantastic because a lazier scene would have just had us sitting back and watching from a distance and just seeing this kiss happen. In some ways, it would have been a bit more voyeuristic. We would have been Max hiding in the storeroom, right? But we get to be part of it. We get to see the emotions. And I think that that's just really well done. And something that I love about Abby Jacobson as Carson is she's really good at emoting. She does these great expressions across her face. We see all of these expressions. The other thing that I want to point out, and I think this is kind of funny, something that we experience as queer viewers a lot is how does the camera, and it's not necessarily like a male gaze issue, but how does a camera historically focus on two women kissing? And it's always like through a window, through a keyhole, there's some gauzy like fabric in the way. It is something that's very well known. Like there's this discomfort with showing women kissing. And so this, of course, leans into it. And we are right there. We are like in everyone's shoes. And so I think that's a great moment for queer representation. I think it's a great moment for the viewers that want to see that are excited about, hey, there's not only same-sex love here, but it is in episode one. It is right there, front and center. And that's a great moment.
Yeah. You know, to build on that, it wasn't the sort of chaste kiss that often happens. They did show it with emotion, with passion. You could feel Carson's nervousness, but excitement. Whereas, yeah, a lot of other sorts of media just will do something that is very simple, or of course they cut away or something like that. And I think overall the series did a good job of showing that romantic chemistry between women and passion between women and, you know, queer people without being pendulum, I think, has swung in some streaming media because you can show anything. It didn't get into the sort of thing that's voyeuristic or, I mean, frankly, a show like this for me is something I'm probably going to be watching with friends, talking about with friends. We know that a lot of streaming shows, they go too far in the opposite direction where it's like, that's too, I'm not watching this to see that much intimacy, but I don't want it to be a single peck on the cheek. And I felt like they captured this very well of giving you the feeling, making it clear that there's romantic interest, particularly later in the series when there are sex scenes, but finding the right balance of making it tasteful, explicit, but not, frankly, pornographic. And actually, I wanted to talk a little bit about Carson as a character. I mentioned that she reminds me of the Abby character on Broad City. And a theme that I wanted to bring up was Carson as kind of a female Nebish, which is a trope, Nebish being a Yiddish word, a trope that you see a lot, particularly in Jewish characters, Jewish written characters, Abby Jacobson being Jewish from the Northeast. So am I. This type of trope you see in characters portrayed by people like Woody Allen, George Costanza on Seinfeld, Larry David, it's usually used for a man to describe someone who's kind of timid, always getting in their own way, tripping over themselves, more book smart, but not really street smart. Someone who you feel bad for because they just can never get it together. And they're sort of always a little bit of a mess, a little bit in shambles, disheveled. And the moment that we meet Carson, that was what came to my mind first, of kind of being like a female Nebish. Going back to that first scene in which she's racing to catch the train, which I need to say, trains are dangerous. Please do not run toward a moving train. It's so dangerous, guys. But she's running toward the train. She falls over. Her underwear is exposed. Her bra's out. She meets a family of people she knows from town. She's just a mess.
Can I just jump in to say, though, that I love this intro so much because she's like, clearly she's got like this heavy bag. She's clearly leaving. And the people she runs into are like, see you at choir practice this afternoon. She's like, oh, totally. And they're like, don't forget the pie. And she's like, well, won't forget the pie. Like, everyone here is clearly lying, right? Like, there, no one thinks she's going to show up with pie. I love that. And I do love, by the way, not to hijack, because we're going to come back to this nebbishness, but I do love that it introduces the idea of this isn't just a historical fiction show. This is going to have a lot of comedy. It sets the tone as this show's not going to take itself too seriously. And it also introduces Carson as the everywoman, right? She is flustered. She's funny, but she means well. And I think it really does set it up well, but it also brings in that slightly slapstick component, that improv background that a lot of these actors bring. So when Carson gets on the train and she's like, Jesus, and then she walks past Nun, right? And then she's like, we miss you, Jesus, right? Like, to me, it's very that old school Leslie Nielsen Naked Gun type of humor where there are just random nuns in places that they shouldn't be. So to go back to your Nebish, though.
No, I mean, Carson, I'm pretty sure is not written as Jewish, but who would say we miss you? I don't know. Like, would a Christian character usually have that as a response when they see a bunch of nuns?
I think most of us would just be quiet. But I mean, the point is, because she does this later when she's at the church, what it shows is that Carson is just this awkward person who feels compelled to justify herself around other people. I do think it fits.
to me, in a good way, I think, and this is often something where a lot of Jewish actors and comedians in the past, you know, not that this has to be done in today's era, but a lot of times in the past, it is the sort of thing where Jewishness is kind of downplayed. It's either turned up so much that people see it so explicitly and they expect you to have to show you're Jewish and show up like holding a menorah. But there are ways in which the Carson character communicates and the actor's sense of comedic timing and physicality and speaking style that are so clear to me, again, being a Jewish person from the Northeast, that that's where her roots are. And I think it's hilarious. And I don't think it's a bad thing. And yeah, getting back to the Nebish, I think it's usually a character that you pity. It usually would be something like Carson runs, she meets the family in town, the train pulls away, she doesn't get on it, and cue the Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David, you know, that outro music where it's just like, well, I'm again the hapless person who didn't catch my train. And usually that character kind of gives up and they stay the same. And what I love seeing is how the show turned that trope on its head, because instead we're meeting Carson when she's doing something really brave and she doesn't stay the same. She's not just, I'm going to be the same kind of feel bad for me, annoying, get in my way character. You know, we don't feel pity for her. We're rooting for her. We're seeing that she is leaving home to play baseball and follow her dreams. And it's setting up the arc for her character throughout the show. And so I found it hilarious. I mean, I find those characters and I think they are found very funny in popular media. And I thought it was cool how I felt like she was taking from those older comedic roots and tropes, but putting it in a character who is in a modern show. Obviously, it's a historical setting, you know, but bringing it to a character that you wouldn't necessarily expect. But that actually, that brings up something I wanted to ask you about and talk about, which is, what is the setting supposed to be fully of this show? Because there are, obviously it's set, you know, it discusses the Rockford Peaches, which were a real team in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. It is accurate that in the 1940s, many men had been shipped off to serve in World War II. And so the Women's League was created in part to draw attention when a lot of men were gone. But there are some things about the show that seem like they don't fit. For example, the speech patterns of the characters and the terms and the language they use. And a big thing at the end that I'm sure was an intentional choice was using in the final scene the song Another Little Piece of My Heart, sung by Janis Joplin, which came out in the late 1960s. There had been, I want to note, a version of it recorded, or the original version, in 1967 by a gospel singer named Irma Franklin. Now, obviously, it still is a song from the 1960s, but if you listen to the Irma Franklin version, it has more echoes of music at this time. You know, it sounds more sort of traditional instruments, whereas the Janis Joplin version is very psychedelic, rock, soul influenced with very synthesized guitars and distortion. So when it plays at the end, you're, you know, a little bit kind of jolted out of, we're in the 1940s, we've been hearing that music, seeing those hairstyles and clothing and this, and then all of a sudden it ends with a song that's clearly not from that era. What do you think the intention of that was?
Yeah, I mean, it's the question of historical anachronisms, and do they detract or do they add? So when we think about this as a historical fiction, so much research went into the show. So a lot of critics of the show have said, oh, it's too woke, you wouldn't have people of color, you wouldn't have whatever. And that's incorrect. You did have Canadians, you did have Hispanics that played in the Women's League, all of these things. many of the criticisms are wrong from people that misunderstood just how diverse American history is. So there's that. And yeah, let's be honest, any sports team is going to have a bunch of queer women. Absolutely. This league had a bunch of lesbians or bisexuals. So that part is correct. Now, the question of the linguistic patterns, totally true. And actually, someone asked the creator, Will Graham, about that and said, you know, why, like, you guys clearly are speaking modern language. Was that intentional? And the answer is yes. For me, it threw me in the first episode. I was like, wait, they didn't speak like this. On the other hand, I actually think that's a really interesting part of the show. And I think it makes it in some ways more accessible to modern people. We're almost 100 years on. I have horrible math. We are like 80 years on, which I rounded up to 100. But this idea of what sounds archaic now to us then would have sounded like what we're hearing now, right? So it's kind of this idea of what does it sound like? It's kind of like if we do Shakespeare now, it sounds so weird. But then if you give it modern language, people are like, what's this? So it's kind of the reverse of Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio. We're taking a historical context and giving it modern language. So I'm for it. I think it works. I think you have to just roll with it. But yeah, actually, when that Janis Joplin song came out, I thought it was really weird. I don't think they necessarily had to do some old-timey 1943 song, but it definitely was like, why this song? Of all the songs in the world, like, why this song? And I don't have an answer to that. But Emma, I want to drill down, because you have this theory, this headcanon theory about how all of this fits together that I think everyone needs to hear, because it's crazy and it totally works.
Yeah, so making the rounds on social media is a clip from the Broad City show where the characters of Abby and her best friend Alana are talking about, I believe it's Alana's grandmother played for the Rockford Peaches, and it's a throwaway sort of line. But and this is just my headcanon. I have no sort of insight into this being a real theme created for the show, but when I was watching it, something that helped make sense of all this to me was the idea that this is one of the Broad City characters' dream about what it was like when the grandmother was playing in that league. And so it would have brought in, if you think of it as a dream sequence, a fantasy sequence about a real historical time, it would have brought in some of that modern speaking, some music from a different period. Again, telling the actual story, but some elements of it, it would make sense if it was someone's modern, you know, sort of remembrance of what things were like. You wouldn't have it be told with 1940s speech patterns. You would have different elements come in. You would have things that later in the series seem a little bit fantastical. For example, obviously there were queer players. That's something that players who were actually on the team later came out and said, yeah, that was the case. But you may not have had, as we see later in the series, as many people who are kind of openly out kissing in public, you know, being less careful about having cover. So yeah, that's my theory, that it is somewhat of a perhaps Broad City dream sequence, but in all the right ways.
I love it. I love that AU. I love it. I'm just going to believe that now. We talked about this idea of the appearance of people of color and how do you tell a story about people of color in a time period in which Jim Crow still exists, racism is still so rampant. Something that I think that's interesting about this show is this show said, we're going to find a way to do it. And I think when I see Carson and Max, I think of their stories as being like a Venn diagram that occasionally overlaps. And those overlap points become the interesting point. Well, all of it's interesting, but they're interesting points, right? So for example, we have Carson and we meet Carson. She's going to go play baseball and do all this stuff. And then we meet Max and their stories are separate. But oh, look, they briefly overlap at the tryouts, but not really. But when they really overlap in episode one is right after Greta has kissed Carson. And it's so funny because this overlap point is like, yeah, Max has kissed women too. This is Carson's first time, but this is not Max's first time. And they share this moment. Now they have this shared secret, but it's this moment in which their lives intersect. And it's not even in baseball yet. And so the show has these characters, Max and Clance, looking out at these baseball players. But it's not just they're these side characters who are 10% of the show. It's fully 50% of the show. And so we have these storylines that are able to weave through each other. And I think it's really fantastically done. I'm very hopeful, of course, the show gets a second season. And I'm curious how that weaving continues, because we all knew that Max could never make the team. That would be historically anachronistic. It would be too far. But how do you continue to tell these stories with that Venn diagram, that moment where in future episodes, we see Max and Carson just playing ball, playing catch in essence? Like, do more people join that midnight field?
I'll say I actually, in episode one, I really liked Max and Clance and their story more. I was more drawn to it than the Carson Greta storyline. And I know the internet loves the Carson Greta ship, and I get it. But, you know, there was something, again, going back to what we discussed about seeing that friendship, having a sense that it was so deep, the way that it was written, the way that it was acted, that really just pulled me into it, of wanting to know about these characters' stories, their lives. And something that I wish was explored more was the relationship between Greta and her best friend, Joe. And I'll also mention, Greta says that they're friends from growing up in Queens, but Greta does not have a Queens or New York accent, which, again, is one of those things that sort of surprised me to set them from there. But, you know, we don't see that same sort of bond, even though it's mentioned that Greta and Joe have been childhood friends. It's clear that they have been together for a long time. And I wish a little bit more had been done there to kind of explore that friendship, explore Joe as well as a character.
Yeah. When we meet Greta and Joe, I love that first scene with them when they're arguing over the maps, kind of bantering about the maps. And it's so wonderful because we do have this sense, even though it's only, let's say, a few seconds, we get the sense of the depth of that friendship and what it's like. We also sense a little bit of power imbalance, right? It seems like Greta's running the show and Joe's just kind of holding the bags, literally, because Greta tells her to. I do think that that friendship got a little shortchanged, and that was really unfortunate. And that's why I do hope we see more of that in season two, but I have no idea how they're going to bring Joe back.
So Karen, I wanted to ask you some things in our lightning round in the episode. Three questions. The first one being, what were your favorite lines and maybe something you thought was ad-lib?
Oh my God. So one of the things I love about this show is it's just so funny. And I mentioned before that a lot of these actresses have those improv roots and they really brought it in. And sometimes it really got me wondering, like, hey, was this written into the script or was this someone ad-libbing? So I mentioned before when Clance arrives with Max at the baseball field, like, I love that one. I love when we meet Greta and Carson is giving her speech about Charlie and how much she loves him. And Greta's just like, this is boring. So I love that. I also love Clance when she's watching the white people dance and she's like, what in the howdy doody white Jesus unseasoned chicken kind of dancing is this?
Oh my gosh. I gotta say, that was one of the funniest lines to me. And just to throw in here, the fact that the actress Bomisola Ikumelo is British, when I heard her speaking, I think it was on her BAFTA award win or something related to an award show, I was like, oh my gosh, because she pulled that line off so well. And all of her dialogue in the show, the entire season, I was like, oh my gosh, she sounds so natural. That just made me laugh so much.
I mean, she is just such an amazing actress. She's part of the writing staff. The fact that she's writing about 1943 America when she is British, all of this stuff just is astounding. The accent is dead on. I would never have known that she was not American. Also, and I know we're going to talk about Shirley later because I know you have definitely some opinions about her, but I love her. Kate Berlant, I've seen her stand-up comedy. I just feel like she is ad-libbing all of her lines and I'm here for all of it. But, you know, you asked me what I specifically like. I love the running joke throughout the entire season that Carson comes from a farm. That just every single time someone references it, I'm dead. I love it.
So let me move on to my second question for you, which was, what is the moment that you wanted to see that you wish you'd seen that wasn't in the episode?
You know, when the Peaches find out that they've made the team, and it's not just the Peaches, right? There's the other teams. And we have this montage of everyone running up and seeing what team they made. In a way, for me, that was too quick. They just turn to each other and they're like, we're on the team together. They look at Lupe and I'm like, y'all just met. So I kind of wish that there had been, whether it was a scene before Carson and Greta get drunk and mail the letter, something where there was that little bit more connective tissue formed between these people, or else afterwards where they're kind of strangers and they're like, hey, we're on the team now and I've never met you. I think for anyone that's been on an athletic team where you have that moment of a team coming together, you're not immediately friends. You have no idea who these people are and how you're going to fit together. And some of you won't be friends. So for me, I kind of wish there'd been a little bit more of that.
You know, that's a really good point. And maybe you could elaborate a little bit on that because you have played team sports your whole life. So what's it like for you? What's it been like when you start on a new team and you are getting to know people and feeling people out?
So there's kind of two aspects to that. When they show up and they're at tryouts, I mean, this really is a competition. You don't know any of these other people. You don't have any loyalty to them. You're just trying your hardest. You just don't know how it's going to go. And then even when you get on that team, those first few days, it's figuring out, who am I going to be friends with? Who am I never going to click with? Just really feeling the mood of it. It takes a while to really become that team.
So let me finish by asking you third question in today's series. Who is your favorite Peach so far?
Oh boy. Episode one, we haven't really met them yet. We haven't really met Esty. We've met Shirley a little bit. There are definitely people we haven't met yet. So for me, it's still Carson, because this is the only one that we've really started to establish a bond with. And again, as we said before, she's the nebbish character. She's the everyman. She's the one that got onto a train with her bra hanging out and walked past some nuns. She is the one with whom we've already established that emotional connection. And she's the lens through which we'll see the rest of the team.
Yeah, I agree with that, that the show, whether or not you believe my personal headcanon about it having this Broad City lens, the show definitely moves forward through Carson's eyes and through Max's eyes as well in that sort of parallel storytelling that we discussed. So I think we're going to close out today by talking a little bit about the visuals and the presentation of the colors, the costumes. I really liked it. What are some of your thoughts on that?
I think that things like that, things that are in the background yet not in the background, are for most viewers, they don't even clock that it's happening. No one's sitting there thinking, oh, was that an oversaturation of the film or undersaturation?
Oh, I'm sitting there thinking it.
Yeah, like I'm just watching. I'm just here for the plot. But it's so important and it really influences. So I want to turn that back on you. Emma, you're sitting there watching the colors. Do you feel like it's bringing you in? How are you feeling watching this?
So what I immediately noticed was the costuming. You're right. For a lot of people, that stuff, they're not paying much attention to. I read some interviews with the costume designer saying that she intentionally picked materials and dyes to be more consistent with that era. To me, it looked really good. I thought that even though it's digital, I mean, I'm almost sure it's digital. People are not doing stuff on film for mainstream production now. It has a little bit of a slightly washed out feel, which I think sends you a little bit to the past as opposed to the super bright HD, honestly, superhero movie visuals we're used to seeing right now. And I thought with the wardrobe, you could see that the materials, they draped a certain way that was more old-fashioned, the cuts, the fabrics, and the clothing. And I thought the colors looked pretty good too, because generally in the past, when people were using more natural fabrics like cotton, they hold color differently than the synthetics that we're much more used to seeing today.
I have no idea about any of this, by the way. I'm actively learning. I'm looking at my own clothing right now. And also, because no one else can see what I'm wearing the equivalent of yoga pants and a soccer t-shirt, because I am the sporty dyke.
So a lot of clothing today is polyester. It's synthetic blends and it holds very vivid colors. You know, think of like the 1970s. Now, there were a lot of muted greens and yellows and natural tones. But when you put things into synthetic fabrics or the 1980s, those neons, they can hold color that way. Whereas things like cotton, linen, they don't tend to hold color in that same rich way. When you wash them, the color will wear out differently. And to me personally, it looked like they captured some of that in the colors that they have. It didn't look like they just went out to the sporting goods store and bought some polyester jerseys and threw them in it.
You know, when we first meet Jo, she is wearing a plaid shirt. It's white and yellow, and she's in a baseball hat. And I'm like, you could actually see that a lesbian on the street today. And for me, for a moment, I was like, whoa, is this a costuming fail? This looks very modern. But what I'm hearing from you is that those patterns would have been common at the time. Jo would not have stood out.
You know, that's a really good question that I want to look into more. But I do think that we get surprised at how many looks could have been put into modern times, particularly with the beginning emergence of women wearing pants. That wasn't something that was widely done. I mean, probably even through the 1960s and even the 70s, you wouldn't have seen a lot of women wearing pants. There were places where it was really realistic to say you're not allowed to do this. Not only would it have damaged the idea of the team as being feminine and girly, but it wasn't widely done. You know, there were movie stars who did it. There were people who did it in certain settings. But for a regular everyday wear, things were different. Things would have been more formal at that time. But yeah, it is cool to see like, oh, these were also just regular people. You know, I wish I could know, like, where did Jo buy her clothing? Like when the costume designer was thinking about this, where did Jo go? I think later it was she made a comment about wearing men's boxers and buying them for her brother, quote unquote. Like, was she shopping in the men's section? Was she going to sort of a special tailor to get things made? I mean, I don't think she had the money to do that.
That kind of applies to Lupe. It applies to Jess, all of the more masculine presenting women. I mean, a bunch of these peaches have a lot of brothers.
You know, I think for Jo in particular, it probably would have been more difficult because she's not straight size. And so some things cut for men may not have fit her as well because of her body shape.
The struggle is real. Man pants do not have big butts and they are way too roomy in the crotch.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's another thing I think even today that people deal with who are wanting to buy more masculine looking clothing, who have a more stereotypically feminine body. How do you find stuff that fits? And that's something I think we should discuss later as the series moves on, because we obviously do meet characters who are wearing things that we do find out are specially tailored to them.
Whoa, whoa, that was deep right there. That actually took me a minute because I'm a little slow.
But yeah, they're just, I thought it was good, but did you think it looked very saturated, the colors?
I mean, not hyper saturated. One of the things that I really like if I'm watching something, I like the colors to not be quite realistic. And what I mean by that is I don't want to watch something in which it looks like someone shot it on their iPhone. I don't want to feel like I'm there. I want to feel like I'm watching something. And so one of the ways that a creator can do that is by shifting the colors, either oversaturating, as you said, undersaturating. If you undersaturate, it's, as you said, more old-timey or more dreamlike. Hypersaturation, again, creates that distancing effect. So I'm actually a fan of the slight oversaturation. I think it can go too far. Death on the Nile, for example, as a recent movie that came out, was hypersaturated, and it was, I really didn't like that. But I just don't want to feel like this is just anything. I do want to feel like I'm watching a movie or something that's fictional. I think just to kind of put in a funny plug here, one of the things that I noticed on the costuming is how much plaid there is. And I really didn't know if that was an inside joke about lesbians, because you notice that the plaid is primarily worn by the queer female characters, or whether plaid was actually that common in the era. I kind of hope it's a little of both, but I definitely hope it's an inside joke about lesbians wearing plaid.
That is a great topic that will, now this has gotten me thinking, we have to explore this more as the podcast goes forward.
We need to Google this. How common was lesbian plaid in 1943?
And people can't see, but I happen to be wearing a checkered shirt right now myself. It was not intentional, but when I put it on, I did think I'm channeling a little bit of Joe in my choices today.
Right there. A little Joe in your life.
Yeah, I mean, later we're definitely going to have to talk about Greta's silhouettes and her makeup and everything was...
The hair. Yeah. Oh my God. Everyone's hair is just amazing.
I mean, gorgeous. But yeah, I love getting some love for the other characters and looks that, you know, don't scream of what you expect from that period.
Absolutely. So, okay. Final last minutes. Who was your favorite actress in this episode?
My favorite, it had to be Clance. Again, I think Bomisola Ikumelo does such an amazing job of convincing me that she is an American, a very funny American, a very loyal friend who also isn't afraid to call her friend out. You know, I really appreciate in this episode and as the season moves forward that she isn't just the funny friend stereotype, that she has her own hopes and dreams with her comics, that she also has her own life with her new marriage and seeing the exploration of her relationship and her role as a wife. That's something in the second episode that we see a lot more of. I felt like she was a very multidimensional character and that the acting was so funny anytime she was on screen. And again, she and Max, just them playing off each other, I knew that I was going to really enjoy it and really be drawn into the story. So what about you?
I want to say the same thing, but I don't want to be redundant. So instead, I want to give a shout out to Abby Jacobson and Will Graham as the creators of the show. They started development in 2018. They interviewed tons of people. They worked so hard. I mean, talk about a labor of love, putting together something so amazing. And I think it's really easy for people to see the actresses on screen and be like, oh, I love this actress or whatever. But I think we need to really stress that a lot of the success of this show is because of the writers. It's because of the creators. It's because of the costume department. We're going to talk about the actresses and the characters because that's what we see. And we often don't see what's behind the curtain, but absolutely the success of the show is because of the entire village it took to make it. So absolute props to them. They did an amazing job. And I think the success of the show really reflects everything that went into it. So Emma, where can our listeners find us on social media? Because this isn't just you and me talking. This is everyone talking and having that community. We're all peaches, right? Where can they talk to us?
We're all fruits. I think that's what they, is that what they say in the first episode? We're fruits now?
Yeah, we're all fucking fruit is what Greta says, I believe.
So the Peaches Aren't the Only Fruit podcast for right now, you can find us wherever you listen to your podcasts, but also at the PATOF podcast on Twitter. That's at PATOF podcast. We are going to be expanding our social media presence soon. Please come interact with us, send us feedback. You can also find us individually. I'm Emma. I'm at Plateless Ordinary on social media, Instagram, also at platelessordinary.com. And Karen?
I'm Karen. You can find me at les_dish. And I talk all things gay. It's not just A League of Their Own. I kind of float between a whole bunch of queer representation. And so I talk about a bunch of shows, whether it's telenovelas, movies, whatever it is. I'm always talking about things. It's what I do. We do hope that you'll talk to us because you know what? Otherwise, it's just the two of us talking to each other. Thanks for listening. And we'll catch you next time on Peaches Aren't the Only Fruit podcast.